Any questions about anything from last time? Let's see, this is the Math 428 homepage. Tilda Bell / MA 428. Say the first homework assignment is to read chapter 1, and the exercises from chapter 1, number 5, 7, 9, 11, those are due on Monday. So I'd like you to bring them into class and drop them on the desk here in the beginning of the hour. And I'll be putting the second assignment in this spot here early next week. And let's see, there was something in this. You'll notice on the homepage there's this thing at the bottom called the aftermath. That's where I post the lecture notes, and you can find the audio of the Boilercast only. So in the last lecture, lecture 4, I wrote out the formula for a Fourier series in the top line there, and then I was going to mess around with these new things, e to the I n theta. So there was formulas for the cosine and the sine in terms of e to the I theta, and I plugged those in to the Fourier series, where the cosine theta goes and the sine theta goes. And then I just realized that when I looked at it afterwards that I kind of went from, I went to this formula maybe quicker than I should have. So if you look at this thing, when I combined them and got e to the I nx here, this is the cn, this number right here. And I wanted to show you that cn is given by this very clean formula. And this would be the, this goes e to the minus I nx, this would be the c minus n. And I thought I'd spend a little bit of time today going carefully from this right here to this formula for the cn. I kind of blasted through it. Any questions about that while I've got it on the screen? Or about anything? Okay, let me switch back over here. The main subject today is going to be Bessel's inequality, but in the beginning here, I wanted to mess around with this e to the I n business. So remember, e to the I theta is cosine theta plus I sine theta. And a fun thing to do is, I would call this fun, is to do this. E to the I alpha plus beta. Let's see, that would be equal to cosine alpha plus beta plus I sine alpha plus beta. And you can also write it, I'm going to demonstrate this today. We're going to see right now that these two things are equal. That this e to the I alpha plus I beta is e to the I alpha times e to the I beta. And the way to see that, let's see, that would be equal to cosine alpha plus I sine alpha times cosine beta plus I sine beta. And when you write those out, and multiply them like complex numbers, you get, let's see, the real part would be cosine alpha cosine beta minus sine alpha sine beta. I guess I should have left myself more room, sorry. Can't do this with paper. Plus I, let's see, the imaginary part would be, I get imaginary when a cosine alpha hits a sine beta, and another real part when a sine alpha hits a cosine beta. And today, I'm doing it this way. I know the trig formulas for the cosine of a sum of two angles, and this, sure enough, is the cosine of alpha plus beta. And this is the sine of alpha plus beta. Those are the trig identities you can derive from triangles. So notice that this is equal to this. And this is equal to this. And so that means this identity is true. These two things are equal. Okay, today I deduced that from trig identities. Here's a fun thing to do, is I can also deduce this using complex variables. I know some of you are going to take 530 from me, which is to do complex variables, and there I study the complex exponential. And this thing is a basic property of the complex exponential. So a great thing, fun thing to do in that class is to deduce all the trig identities because we know this for the complex exponential. But today we're going to go do it from the point of view of trig identities. So this is a true thing about the complex exponential. So I'll call that a fact. Fact. E to the I alpha times plus I beta equals E to the I alpha times E to the I beta. For example, E to the I n theta times E to the minus I n theta is going to be equal to E to the 0, which is 1. That's one of the things they want you to do in the homework, and to use these facts. By the way, if you're going to calculate integrals, the integral, let's just take from A to B, of e to the I n theta d theta, that would stand for the integral from A to B of cosine n theta d theta plus I times the integral from A to B of sine n theta d theta. That's all it means when you integrate a complex function. It means split it into real and imaginary parts and do the integral separately. That would make sense if you're going to define this in terms of Riemann sums too. So it's the most natural way to define that kind of integral. And then when you do these things, integrals, you would get, integral of cosine would be 1 over n sine n theta. And this would be minus 1 over n I cosine n theta. And we'd evaluate between A and B. And you realize that that is exactly what you would do if you were doing freshman calculus. This is e to the I k something, where the k is I n. And the antiderivative of that would be 1 over I n e to the I n theta evaluated between A and B. So it means your freshman calculus formulas for integration hold even when there's a complex I n there. Because what? Let's see. Is that true? I think it is true. Of course it's true. I know it's true, though, so I'm not going to check this. But if you're going to check this, you would multiply it out and say, aha, yeah, those two things are equal. So it means with these things, you can do your basic calculus formulas, and they all hold exactly the same as in the real case. Same as e to a k times x from real calculus. Okay. So now I wanted to go back and show you that calculation that I blasted through. So back to the CNs. I wanted to show that f of x was a sum as n goes from minus infinity to a plus infinity of cn e to the inx, where the cn's are 1 over 2 pi, integral from minus pi to pi, f of x times e to the minus inx dx. This is going to be true even if I put a minus n here. So if this is a minus 12, then this would be an I times plus 12. So it works even when n's are negative. And so here's a little bit slowdown of what I should have showed you last time. So here's y. Let's see. I saw from that work I did that the cn was going to be, what did it turn out to be? 1 half an minus ibn. And the an was 1 over pi integral from minus pi to pi of f of x cosine nx. And the bn, let's see, was 1 over pi integral from minus pi to pi f of x sine nx. And so the I get a 1 over 2 pi there, and when I collect it together, I would get 1 half, 1 over 2 pi. I'll put those integrals together, minus pi to pi. I can pull the fx out, and then I'm left with cosine nx minus I sine nx. And sure enough, that is exactly e to the minus inx. And by the way, e to the minus inx is equal to e to the inx complex conjugate. Did I define the complex conjugate? X plus iy conjugate. The complex conjugate is x minus iy. So this is like an inner product of f of x with this complex function, and in a complex inner product, you always take the conjugate in the second variable if you're dealing with complex inner products. And we're going to think about it like that soon. Anyway, I meant to slow down and include that in last lecture, but I somehow blasted through it. Any questions about that? The homework's going to ask you to calculate various things by dealing with these things in clever ways. And once you see what they mean, it's a very clean way of calculating all this stuff. It's kind of a powerful way to do it. No questions? Well, let me then start today's subject matter, which is Bessel's inequality. And since Bessel's inequality works in lots of different contexts, whenever you try to expand a function in terms of orthogonal things, Bessel's inequality is lurking in the background. So I think I'll just do it for on the interval from minus pi to pi. So on the interval from minus pi to pi, suppose we have a family of orthogonal functions. So let's suppose that the phi n's are, let's make them continuous. They're probably even better than being continuous. Functions on minus pi to pi, which are orthogonal. And so I'm going to write the inner product like this. The phi n inner product with phi m, that's going to stand for the integral from minus pi to pi of phi n of x, phi m of x. If these are real functions, I don't put a conjugate there. But if I'm talking about complex valued functions, I'm going to put a conjugate in this spot. In the real case, it doesn't matter because they're real. But when we talk about complex, when these are the e to the inx and e to the imx, there's going to be a conjugate right here, which is going to make this one an e to the minus imx. I'm going to assume that they're orthogonal, which means that that's equal to 0 if n is unequal to m. And it's equal to, and I'm going to make it orthonormal, which means I'm going to normalize them, so this the integral will be 1 if n equals m. And this 1 here means that they're more than orthogonal, they're orthonormal. They've been normalized so that that integral is 1. And we'll write this for the norm of the. If you have an inner product, then you always have a norm. And so the norm of a function squared is going to be equal to the inner product of f with itself. And that would be the integral from minus pi to pi of absolute f squared. By the way, this is a good reason to put that conjugate there if this was complex, because then this would stand for the complex modulus squared of a function. So this is a true formula even if f is complex value. At the moment, everything in sight is real. Okay, so I've got a bunch of orthogonal functions. In fact, I'm going to assume I have infinitely many of such phis, like I do in the Fourier series case. And so the big question is, can I expand f like Johann Bernoulli did? Let's think about it like this. Here's the big question. I haven't said it yet. But if f is equal to a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity of cn phi n, then I could multiply that thing by phi m and integrate. So I'll multiply on the left by a phi m, and then I would have on this side a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity of cn phi n phi m. I just multiplied that by phi m. And now I'm going to integrate from minus pi to pi. And if everything goes well, the integral of a sum will be the sum of the integrals. If things converge uniformly and nicely. And the great thing about orthogonality is that all of these are 0 except for the 1 when n equals m. So I'd get 0, 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, but the only one that's not 0 would be, let's see which one, it would be c sub m times the integral of phi sub m squared. And here's where it's nice that those have been normalized. This integral is 1. If I normalize those and divide by the right constant, so that's true. That's 1. And so I get this very simple formula for the C sub n. So if this is going to happen, the Cm has to be equal to this integral. And that integral is the inner product of f with phi sub m. So the fact is, if we can expand something in an orthogonal expansion, the CMs have to be this. Nice formula. So I haven't said what the big question is. The big question is, if I take the CMs to be that, can I expand an F?
do we get? F equals CM, a sum of CM phi M.
And if you think about Fourier series, maybe not. If I throw away a few of those sine terms, if I don't have enough, there's no way I can make them add up. If I have all the sine terms like I'm supposed to in Fourier series, it turns out to be a true thing, and we're going to see it later in the semester. But if I were to throw some of those sine terms away, I wouldn't have enough to make every function expandable. So there's something, this has to be a special kind of orthogonal sequence. It has to be what's called, so here's what we're, if we think about it, Yes, for F equals the sine of Cn, sine nx. On say 0 to pi. I didn't show you that, but that's a true thing. I can expand functions in Fourier sine series. But if I were to toss some of those sine functions and not have enough, like if I started from 10 to infinity and threw away the beginning, I wouldn't be able to expand every function. I really need all of them.
But if I tossed out some, if I tossed out a few, sine mx's, then I can no longer expand every f.
So this property of being just right is called completeness. If I can do that for any old f, those things are called a complete orthonormal basis, in fact. So a word. This set of orthogonal functions is called complete. If every function can be expanded in terms of them. Be expanded. Facts that we'll see along the way. All the sine functions are complete. Sine nx, I would take 1 to infinity, on the interval 0 to pi are complete. Let's call that A. And B, the functions 1, cosine nx, and sine nx are a complete orthogonal set. I didn't normalize them. I didn't make the integrals 1. I would have to divide them by constants to make them normalized. They're complete on minus pi to pi. Okay, so here's Bessel's, and it's actually an easy thing. And here's what I do. I'm going to take a partial sum. Let's let CMs be those inner products of F with the orthogonal thing. And now I'm going to ask myself, what is the L2 norm, the square integrable norm of F minus summation C? I'm going to go from 1 to capital N, not the full thing. I'm going to calculate that and see what I get. By the way, this thing being an integral and a square is greater than or equal to 0.
need that at the end. Okay, so let's see. What is this? This is a square. Sorry. And so, let's see. That would be, I'm going to write it as the integral from minus pi to pi of f of x minus the sum as n goes from 1 to m, n rather, phi n of x.
Squared.
And let's, so let's see, that's, to calculate that and write it out in gory detail, I'm going to write that as the integral from minus pi to pi of f of x, I'm going to write this as the sum from 1 to n, I didn't have my cn's here, cn times fn of x, and I'm going to write this as the same sum, but this time I'm going to use m's. M going from 1 to n, cm phi m of x, dx. All right, so let's just multiply those out and crank it out. That will be the integral from minus pi to pi of f of squared dx. That's the... And let's see, then I would get minus, a sum as n goes from 1 to n of cn.
Integral phi n times f. When I multiply these two terms together.
So here I would get an integral from minus pi to pi of phi n of x times f of x.
Let's see, so that I have this times this, that's that one. And now I have this times this, that's that one. Now I've got to have this times this.
That would be minus a sum as m goes from 1 to m of cm times the integral from minus pi to pi of phi m times f dx.
And then the last thing I would have, this minus times this minus would be a plus, and I'd get all these things multiplied together.
That looks ugly, but that's the part that's going to be easy. So I'd get plus a sum as n goes from 1 to n, and m goes from 1 to n. Clean that up. A cn times a cm. And most of these are going to be 0 because these things are orthogonal. Okay. Look at those for a second. This thing is cn. This thing is cm. That was the formula we had for those things. And these are mostly equal to 0. This is what I would call the delta function, the Dirac, not Dirac, Kronecker delta function.
That's equal to 1 when n is equal to m and equal to 0 otherwise. And so what do we get? What do we get? That's going to be a sum of cn squared. Cn.
Yeah. So this is going to give me the L2 norm of F squared. minus the sum of Cn squared minus the sum of Cm squared. Of course, those are the same. And this one is going to be a plus. This is equal to 1 when n is equal to m, so I get Cn times Cn, and all the rest are 0. Okay, so now I've got you Bessel's inequality. This one cancels that one, and I'm left with, so here it is, aha. I got 0 is less than or equal to the norm of that f minus that sum. And that, I calculated, is equal to the norm of f squared minus the sum of Cn squared.
So I can put this on the other side and get that the sum of squares is less than the norm of f squared.
That's Bessel's inequality. Actually, I guess that's on the way to Bessel's inequality.
Bessel's inequality is let n go to infinity now. It doesn't matter how big n is, these things always add up to something less than or equal to that.
So that now, Bessel's is you let n go to infinity. And you get famous Bessel's inequality. And the consequence is Fourier coefficients have to tend to 0. So a consequence Fourier coefficients all tend to 0 as n goes to infinity, both the sine ones and the cosine ones,
because of that fact. Because the tail end of a convergent series has to go to 0. That's cool.
Questions about that? So that's an exciting... That's the first time I proved something about Fourier series.
I didn't prove they converge yet, but I did show today, using Bessel's inequality, that Fourier coefficients have to tend to 0.
That sort of gives us hope that thing is going to converge and the tail end is going to go away. Do I see a question?
Yeah, I just forgot, but in general, inner products are not symmetric.
Yeah, they are.
They are.
Real ones are.
Okay, but the
complex ones are, if you change the order, then it's the conjugate of what you started with. Mm-hmm. And so far we haven't dealt with complex ones yet. We're going to get better at complex ones when I switch from sines and cosines to e to the inx. Then I'll have to deal with that. But here's a cool thing. I'll try to do this. I have this fancy tablet PC here so I can be sneaky. Let's go do this calculation again. Okay, so I had this thing. Let's call this one, I'm going to call this E star. This is an error. It's greater than or equal to 0.
I want to compute the same thing. These are the special Fourier coefficients. I claim that these special Fourier coefficients make this thing as small as possible. That's what I'm going to show you.
And so here's how I'm going to show you. That's E star. That's the one with the special ones. But what if I took non-special ones? I guess I need colors. I'll use orange. I'll just call E is going to be this, and instead of Cn, I'm going to put an An there. Okay, then that would turn these to Ans instead of Cns. That would turn these to Ans instead of Cns. That would turn these to ANs instead of CMs, and this to a AM. And this would be an AN, and this would be an AM.
But these would still be CNs, and this would be a CM.
Okay, so what? When I look at that thing, what do I get? I'd write that out. I heard people yawning and dying here, so I'm not going to write it out. But there it all is. I can write it all out. And it would just replace those green CNs with orange ANs. And I'd get a sum, an algebraic sum of numbers. So it would look like this. I'd still get this norm F squared, and then I'd get a sum of numbers. And here's what you get. That E was one with any old A's in there, and then the E star was the one with the Fourier coefficients, the special ones in there. You write it all out and stare at it and realize, aha, that big ugly mess is a sum. The orange, I have orange AN's there, and then minus CN's, a sum of those squares.
If you write it all out and look at it, you'd get that.
That's a sum of squares. That means it's got to be, the worst it could be is zero. So it's greater than or equal to zero.
And what that shows you is that E star makes that error as small as possible. So choosing Fourier coefficients is like your best bet. It makes that error as small as possible. If you choose any other coefficient, it's going to make it that error bigger.
So the consequence is, so here's the, call this a theorem, I guess. Theorem. The Fourier coefficients, I guess you would call this generalized Fourier coefficients. I guess Fourier coefficients involve just the sine functions, but these work for any orthogonal expansion. And there's lots of them out there, by the way. The generalized Fourier coefficients Cn equals the inner product of f with phi n make the error, this is called L2 error because it's a square integral. L2 error, f minus the sum of Cn phi n from 1 to n, as small as possible.
And taking any other C's would make this strictly bigger.
Changing any C's to AN's makes that strictly bigger. So it means that the Fourier coefficients are your best bet. If this is going to work, they're the best bet. And so that's why we know we have to use them, and then we have to work on them from there. Strictly bigger. Let's see, let me slide back for a second and look at that sum of squares.
If any of these are different, one of those things is going to be strictly positive. So that thing will be a positive number on the right. So that means that this error will be strictly bigger. And the only way I get the minimum is if they're all equal to zero, namely AN equals CN.
So you can just read that off from that thing. So I guess the fact is I'll state this for Fourier series. The nth partial sum of a Fourier series is the best L2 approximation to F among all nth degree trig polynomials. That follows from Bessel's inequality. And I should remark, I mentioned Parseval's inequality, so here's a fact that we'll see later on. Parseval's formula. Bessel's inequality becomes an equality exactly when those things form a complete orthonormal basis. When the phi n form a complete orthonormal basis. I didn't use that word yet, but the word is orthonormal basis for the space of L2 functions, meaning square integrable functions on minus pi to pi. And when that happens, Bessel's equality is called Parseval's formula. Or identity. Parseval's identity. And we'll demonstrate Parseval's identity for Fourier series. By the way, this is a good time to say a word I've been holding myself back from saying, namely the word Hilbert space. It's an exciting subject. So you're familiar with vector spaces and like Rn, and you would write a vector, say a vector V. Let's say we have orthogonal vectors. So I'd write C1 times U1 plus, and let's say it's n-dimensional, plus blah, 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 CN, UN. So this is a finite dimensional vector space. Finite dimensional, in fact it's an n-dimensional vector space. Let's make it be Rn if you like. And let's suppose that these u's are orthogonal. So they'd be 0 if n is unequal to m. And let's normalize them so they're 1 if n equals m. That's called an orthogonal basis. And you learned in linear algebra, so that's called an orthogonal basis. The UNs are. And you learned in your linear algebra class, if I dot product this, let's pick a UM, then you can distribute dot product through a sum, and you'd get a sum of CN, UN, dotted with UM, and those would all be 0 except for 1. And it would spit you out the CM times 1. And so, inner product spaces are nice
when you have an orthogonal basis, because then you can, your coordinates are just spit out. This thing is a coordinate.
Cm times 1, Cm equals v dot um, just like this inner product I did with L2 functions. That Cm is a coordinate. In this orthogonal setup.
Well, Fourier series are like doing this, except with infinitely infinitely many functions, exactly the same. And so here's the fancy words that are exciting.
L2 from minus pi to pi is going to be called a Hilbert space. That's going to be the set of functions f such that the integral from minus pi to pi of f squared dx is finite. And I define the inner product and the norm. That's going to be an infinite dimensional inner product space. Is an infinite dimensional inner product space. And in place of those,
in place of the dot product, in place of those functions, I'm going to have the trig functions.
And I'll use these trig functions, e to the inx. N equals 0, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, etc., are an orthonormal basis. Actually, I would need to divide by something. So I won't use orthonormal. I'll just say orthogonal. And they're complete. And so Hilbert,
way back, said, aha, I can treat this space just like Rn, except it's an infinite dimensional space, and I can treat Fourier coefficients just like coordinates. So that was a mind-blowing advance. And he got really comfortable in his own Hilbert spaces and was able to think of these terms in very concrete terms, and very much like in Rn. And these things, the Fourier coefficients, become like coordinates.
And a whole bunch of really fantastic math sort of was invented after that. So we think the Fourier coefficients are just the coordinates.
While that was exciting and 100% correct, Hilbert also discovered deficiencies in the Riemann integral. So I wrote this, and you're saying, what the heck do I mean? What kind of functions? Are they continuous? Can they be unbounded? Do they just have to be Riemann integrable? It turned out that Riemann integrable functions weren't enough. In fact, they botched things up. You get terrible behavior, and you couldn't prove what you needed to prove. Hilbert realized that there's a new space, and there's a new kind of integral that's required to make sense of this subject, and it's the Lebesgue integral. And this was how, in fact, it's exactly because of Fourier series and Hilbert space that the Riemann integral was found to be deficient, and the Lebesgue integral replaced it. And Lebesgue integrable functions are what's meant in that thing right there to become a Hilbert space. So one way to think about this is you could take all the, say, continuous functions and complete them with respect to that norm. Then you would get the Hilbert space. That's kind of fancy math, and it's the kind of thing you'll study in graduate school. I'm going to be able to study Fourier series without getting too fancy into measure theory and Lebesgue integral. We can study convergence without the Lebesgue integral. But when they wanted to get into the finer details and make all this fancy theory work, they had to invent a new kind of integral called the Lebesgue integral. Okay, that's enough for today.
Is the Hilbert space just an infinite dimensional inner product?
Yes.